Thanks, Rob. And thanks for the organizers, Jessica and John and Rob, for the invitation to talk to you today about, this was my original title that Rob suggested, Water Stress Effects on Assimilation, Water Use, and Crop Productivity. You saw the title that I changed it to, but if we take the cursor and if I can find it here. Yikes. Oh, my goodness. Look at the alt text. What I really want to focus on are plant photoprotective mechanisms and why they matter. So I'd like to also acknowledge my colleagues Art Ziegelbaum and Betty Walter Shea. It's been great working with them, and it's been a lot of fun. So here's a sort of an outline of my talk, What we first started to do was look at the influence of water stress on leaf reflectance. And so we did a series of greenhouse experiments with maize and soybean and some other plants and correlated the PAR albedo with leaf relative water content. And at first, we got some great correlations and we were excited, but the more we looked at it, oftentimes, there were better correlations with leaf reflectance and the previous light environment that the leaf had been experiencing. And based on this, we concluded that plant photoprotective mechanisms are responsible for our results. And right now, we're extending this work to the field. So I'll concentrate on the greenhouse stuff and at the end get to the field work, which is a work in progress. It's not quite neatly wrapped up in a nice bundle like the greenhouse work is. Okay. So what we did was we had a series of plants grown in pots. We took half of the plants and watered them every day, sometimes twice a day. And then the other half, we stopped watering them on day one and didn't water them for the rest of the experiment, about 7-8 days, something like that. And every day we make measurements with the spectroradiometer. You can see the head of the instrument there. It's a ASD Field Spec Pro, so it measures reflectance between 400 and 2400 nanometers. And then we also took leaf punches from those plants and weighed them and hydrated them and weighed them and dried them and weighed them and calculated leaf relative water content from those measurements. Very tedious work if you've ever done it. Okay, so here's an example of our results, and you can see that control plant, there was very little change in the reflectance spectrum over the course of a week. Each spectral line is an average of 8 leaves, and you can see that this 1 week period, there's very little change in the reflectance from these leaves. Two features I'd like to point out, if I can get the mouse to work. Oh, here we go. Here's the PAR region, 400 to 700 nanometers. And these two dips in the middle infrared are water absorption features. OK, so here's the first average spectrum we got from the unwatered plants. And watch what happens over the course of a week with these reflectance values. They increase across the whole spectrum. In particular, they increase in the visible part of the spectrum and in these two water absorption features. So this was interesting. These were interesting results. And at first, we were puzzled by them. Along with these increases in reflectance, where's my cursor? Here we go. So here's the PAR albedo, the average reflectance in the PAR band. And you can see it increasing over the course of this experiment at the same time that the stomatal conductance is dropping to virtually zero on these plants. So we're reducing water stress, and the reflectance increases during this period. This increasing PAR reflectance has been shown in several papers for at least 30 years, but no one has really discussed this feature. It's been dismissed due to instrument error. highly correlated. And it's funny because if, you know, in the PAR region, pigments are responsible for this absorption, chlorophyll and other pigments. But in the middle infrared, these two dips are water features where pigments don't absorb. Yet we get this very tight correlation. And we're a bit puzzled by that and wondering what it all meant. We also did chlorophyll extractions and found very little change in chlorophyll content over the course of this week-long period. Okay. So, you know, we know that in the PAR, pigments absorb, no water molecule absorption. In the middle infrared, water molecules absorb, but no pigment absorption, and yet we get this tight correlation between the reflectances in those two features. So that was puzzling to us. And Art and I, and now Betty, have what we call these talk sessions. We get results like this, sit down at lunch or some other time, and spread out our graphs and scratch our heads and say, huh, what's going on there? It was puzzling, I'll tell you. Okay. But look, we got nice tight correlation, or we got a nice response of increasing PAR albedo to decreasing leak relative water content. And the first experiment, the closed symbols, were very exciting to us. We thought, aha, here's a way we can sense water stress, just looking at reflectance. The next experiment, it was a bit more scatter in the data. You can see the open symbols, you know, going up and down over that trend line. And we didn't know what to make of that because when we looked, there was a higher correlation between the PAR albedo and irradiance, how much light had been incident on these plants for the previous hour or two, than there was between the PAR albedo and the leaf relative water content. And this was very puzzling, another one of those harm things. And we didn't know what to make of it. Okay. Well, we talk about this with everybody we know, and one of the people that we talked to was John Markwell, who's a biochemist at the University of Nebraska. And we were talking, showing him our results one time, and he said, chloroplasts move, you know. Well, at the time we didn't appreciate that like we do now, but this proved to be the key for the whole understanding what was going on. Okay, so chloroplast movement is one of what's called a series of photoprotective mechanisms that plants use. Whenever they're absorbing more light than they can efficiently use at photosynthesis, they do something to either not absorb so much light or to dissipate that energy that they've absorbed. If they don't do that, these electrons that are transported in photosynthesis tend to produce free oxygen radicals or hydrogen peroxide, compounds that are detrimental to the plant. So plants have evolved a series of mechanisms to deal with these situations. And generally they're called photoprotective. Here's a graph from Ali Bjorkman and Barbara Deming Adams that shows this. A little busy, but stick with me. It's a light response curve. So here's the rate of photosynthesis, and here's the incident light intensity, and the curve B, the upside-down triangles, shows the light response curve of photosynthesis. Now, if you take the initial slope, this line A, that's the highest slope anywhere on this hyperbolic relation. So that as the light intensity increases, we deviate from that initial slope. And this deviation from the slope, which is shown as curve D from this figure, is called excess energy. Energy in excess of photochemical processes that are occurring in the plant. And this excess energy is what is sensed by the plant to invoke these photoprotective mechanisms. Here's another graph from a table showing some of these photoprotective mechanisms. But the main point is there are two basic strategies when there's too much light coming in. Number one, try not to absorb that light in the first place. Or number two, if you do have to absorb it, then do something else. And amongst the something else things of phototechnology are things like chlorophyll fluorescence. But I'm going to talk about the trying not to absorb so much light in the first place. Many of us are familiar with soybeans whose leaves track the sun when things are photosynthetic, but when stress is induced, then they move the whole leaf so as to avoid absorbing so much radiation. And that's a very very useful photoprotective mechanism. But instead of moving the whole leaf, why not just move the chloroplasts? Here are a couple of images of tobacco cells with the chloroplasts stained as a bright red color. And these are courtesy of Kristen Ilowski in the microscopy facility at UNL. You can see on the left-hand side, under low light conditions, the chloroplasts are arranged so as to intercept the maximum amount of light. So the light would be coming normal to the screen here. So they're spread out over the surface of the cell on the where the light's coming in and absorbing as much as they can. However, under high light conditions, what happens is that the chloroplasts migrate to the periphery of the cell, they stack up, and they shade each other. So what happens? These cells don't absorb as much light, and the reflectance and the transmittance increases. The absorbance decreases. And this chloroplast repositioning has been known since the middle 1800s. Here's a nice picture of my first plant physiology professor at Michigan State University. And he's been immortalized on this coleus leaf by using a negative M light to move the chloroplast and make this picture of his face. Norman Good is his name. He's a great teacher. Okay, so in grasses like in maize, sorghum, millet, the situation is such that if you look at panel A, the chloroplasts are arranged fairly uniformly through the mesophyll cells between the vascular bundles. But as stress increases, as we go down to C, E, G, and I, as stress increases, the chloroplasts move, and in these plants, they move towards the vascular bundle. That opens up a window in between the vein, and also increases transmittance and reflectance. Here's a series of micrographs that we took on sorghum leaves. What we did was just to snip the leaf off the plant to invoke a very quick stress. And actually, it wasn't dried on the lab bench, it was dried on the microscope stage, taped to the microscope stage so we could look at the exact same spot on the leaf. And you can see, I hope. When we started the experiment, it's fairly uniformly green between the veins, but as time goes on, after 90 minutes, you can see this little window of paler green opening up in between in the veins, and that's as a result of the chloroplasts moving. I've got a video of it. If you want to see it later, I can show you. It's known that blue light is what's responsible for initiating this chloroplast movement. And so we did a bunch of experiments, too, using illumination that contains blue light or doesn't contain blue light. And here we show transmittance on the y-axis and the time since we start. This is for a little section of maize leaf that's drying out in the lab. And you can see that the transmittance increases when there's blue light present in the illumination. But if there's only red light, we don't see a change in transmittance. So as a result of all these things, we conclude that chloroplast avoidance movement, as it's known, is responsible for the results that we see, increasing PAR albedo with water stress. And it turns out this is a general response to stress. You can invoke these chloroplast movements not only with water stress, but with salinity stress. Okay, that's a form of water stress. Heavy metal toxicity. And I suspect if you eliminate CO2 from the air, you'll invoke the same things. But that's an experiment that we haven't done yet. So, chloroplast avoidance movement and changes in reflectance. Now, it's
We've convinced ourselves that that's what's going on in the greenhouse with these experiments. Now we want to move out to the field. But as you all know, when we do field work, there's a whole other range of influences on what you're looking at. So we work under the auspices of what's known as the Carbon Science and Modeling Program at UNL. This started as the Carbon Sequestration Program, and it was initiated by a small group of us in 2001, primarily with Shafi Verma, who has now retired. But Shafi was a big eddy covariance person, and he set up three eddy covariance sites at the Agricultural Research and Development Center near Meade, Nebraska. And these are called US NE1, NE2, and NE3. And these are all three Ameriflux sites. They're each a quarter section. Number one is irrigated with a center pivot and is continuous maize production. Number two is a maize soybean rotation, also under a center pivot. And the dryland site, it is also a maize soybean rotation. And all three of these sites are within 4 kilometers of each other. Okay, so at each site we have eddy covariance instrumentation that's quantifying CO2 and water vapor and energy fluxes, as well as a suite of supporting measurements. And over the 14th year of these experiments now, and we see a very good correlation between growing season GPP, gross primary production, and the resulting grain yield. So you can see the soybean data clustered there on the left and the maize data spread out along the right. So with our field work, we're concentrating on gross primary production, those estimates. Okay, so we did similar work that we did in the lab out in the field, where we took the AST and made leaf level measurements. But then we also had a repurposed Hagee sprayer, you can see the picture on the left, that has an extendable boom on it with fibers looking down at the canopy to measure canopy reflectance with an Ocean Optics HR2000. That doesn't quite have the wave band response. It goes from 400 to about 1100 nanometers. Okay, so we're interested in what we see at the leaf level. Does that fit with what we see at the canopy level, and can we tie that to GPP? As I say, it's still a work in progress. Okay, here's some leaf level results. So these are averages of leaves on 9 plants, and we measured the ear leaf that you can see here, and 2 leaves below the ear and 2 leaves above the ear. And you can and we made measurements morning and afternoon. The reason for doing that is because we wanted to obtain reflectance, canopy reflectance readings at similar solar zenith angles to avoid as much as we could any bidirectional effects. Okay, so the morning data are shown in blue, and you can see that the reflectance is smaller in the morning than it is in the afternoon, similar to what we saw in the greenhouse with increasing water stress. This is most prominent on the leaf that's 2 below the ear leaf, and less prominent on the leaves that are at the top of the canopy and experiencing arguably more stress. One thing that happens with chloroplast movement is the chloroplasts will move to the surface of the cell and then to the edge of the cell with stress, and then overnight go back out onto the surface of the cell. But if the stress is prolonged, what happens is they stay on the side, and the plant says, well, thinking like a plant, you know, he says, I'm not going to move those, I'll just have to move them again. So they pile up on the edge, and we think that's what's happening where these reflectances are high early in the day, as well as late in the day. Okay, in 2014, this past summer, we looked at an irrigated site, and you can see that there is very little change in the reflectance between morning and afternoon on any of these leaves. These results are similar to what we see in the greenhouse with our control plant. Okay, so let's look at canopy reflectance in the few minutes left remaining. Okay, so here's looking, there's a camera on the end of that boom, too, looking down at the canopy. And the yellow circle is approximately the field of view of that fiber that you can see sticking into the edge of the circle. Okay, so takes a lot. What we see is here are 36 scans, and typically that's what we take, 36 scans over a transect of maybe 100 yards in the field. And you can see the 36 separate scans on the left graph from the morning data, and the 36 on the right from the afternoon data. And what's immediately apparent is there's more variability in the afternoon. There's also slightly higher reflectance, as I'll show in a second. So the bottom left graph shows the average of all these 36 scans from the morning in blue and the afternoon in red. And you can see a little bit of increase in reflectance in the afternoon, similar to what we see at the leaf level. Not a very large difference, but it's significant, I think, that it extends over the whole PAR waveband, which makes it very difficult to imagine an index that would be sensitive to this, but that's another story. These plants in 2013 were stressed. Here's an average 3-hour gross primary production value for the morning and the afternoon hours. And you can see that on most days, there was stress on this canopy. Unfortunately, we're still waiting for the 2014 GPP data are still in the quality control phase, and so I won't be able to show those to you. But I can show the reflectance spectra from 2014 at the irrigated site. You see the morning on the upper left, the afternoon on the upper right, and a small change in average reflectance, as shown on the lower left, very small, hardly noticeable, and a bit of an increase in the variability in the afternoon. Now, this is the irrigated site, center pivot irrigated. Oops. Okay. You know, tying this to GPP isn't so simple because there's so many other factors that affect GPP, practically everything. Let me just look at 2 days here in the last 2 minutes. Robbie's supposed to be standing up now. So, on the upper left, you can see the incoming PAR as a function of time of, as a function of time of day for day 203 in 2013. And it looks like a fairly clear day. In fact, the morning was clear, the afternoon clouded up a little bit. That's easier to see if you plot the incoming PAR as a function of solar zenith angle. So here are the morning data, comes in like this, the afternoon stays the same, and then it gets cloudy and the incoming PAR drops dramatically. If you look at GPP as a function of solar zenith angle, here's what happens in the morning. And now I apologize because this is the Ameriflex standard, which shows GPP as a negative number. You know, the Ameriflex community is atmospherically oriented, so anything leaving the atmosphere is a negative. So that's why the decreasing GPP in the afternoon looks higher, but really it's closer to zero. If you plot the GPP as a function of incoming PAR, though, on the bottom right, you see the same relationship on this day. No difference. That's in contrast to 4 days later, very clear day, you can see that the incoming PAR as a function of solar zenith angle overlapped. But if you look at the GPP, there was less GPP in the afternoon than the morning. And if you make a pseudo light response curve, like on the lower right, you can see that the GPP versus incoming PAR relationship has shifted over to the right, which makes me want to think that there's more excess light in the canopy in the afternoon on this day than there was in the morning, similar to that graph that Ali Bjorkman had in his paper. So we're still working on this. As I say, the GPP data from 2014 are still being analyzed, but this is the way we're going, and I should say these are preliminary conclusions, but amongst them are that chloroplast avoidance movement is happening in the field, just like in the greenhouse. We're convinced of that. We need to account for these photoprotective responses in remote sensing work. They may have a discernible effect on GPP, but what's more is they probably have an effect on various indices that people use to characterize biophysical features in the canopy. For example, we've been working with Anatoly Gitelson's chlorophyll index, and we see morning and afternoon changes in that index within a day. And that's why we've begun to call it the apparent chlorophyll index. But we have a great opportunity here to understand more of general stress effects on plant canopies, and we're working to get more data than we have now. So thanks for your attention. And,
thanks, Tim. We have time for questions. Back.
So when you look at the photosynthetic activity, flux of that light, there's also a massive non-photosynthetic radiation component.
Right.
That's going to be coincident with that, of orders of magnitude higher. And as we change irrigation levels, tracking those changes in your photosynthetic radiation, you're going to have big temperature changes in the system. Mm-hmm. So how do you sort out the effect that maybe the chloroplasts are moving as a result of a water deficit or and a temperature-related response as opposed to something related to just...
So the chloroplasts are moving as a general response to stress, no matter what's invoking that stress. So high temperatures would likely cause this chloroplast movement at lower light intensities than lower temperatures would. And so, it's difficult once we go to the field to tease out all these separate effects. What's more, any biophysical models of what's going on in the canopy, none of them at present incorporate any of these photoprotective mechanisms. So, it's a challenge. You're exactly right, but it's an opportunity for us to do some more work, I guess.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Thanks, Rob.